Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk about the opening of Elf on Broadway and A Christmas Story. We also talk about a bunch of CDs that have been out there. Christmas Story, again, has released their CD, Carols for a Cure, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Simply Broadway, Cabaret, and Forbidden Broadway. In the news, we talk about the Yankees play, Steve Jobs movie, Disney and Star Wars and Variety, and the use of the exclamation point in the title of a show. So be sure to listen. Thanks.
Is the red butter carbine action be begun? See me standing guard up at my window. I'll protect the neighborhood so outlaws are always locked on, and I'll bombard them from that window. Show those weasels how the Wild West was won. Bang, bang! Let the red butter carbine action be begun. Cause Mandy could be kidnapped by a pack of goons. Our house might be invaded by raccoons. A tiger could escape the zoo and try to rip his shields in two. But she would be okay. I swoop in and save the day. And the girls would sigh and say, oh, Ralphie, when you're big and brave like me, no bully can ever make fun. The kids are crying, Cowboy Ralphie, while my old man's shouting, that boy, he's my son. With a red butter carbine action be begun.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, November 18th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critcherland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You could see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Hello. So we're back in our Sunday morning groove, which is
yes,
most excellent. We had Scandalous, which opened up a few days ago, but Michael saw it and Peter has not, and we have a lot to talk about today, so we're going to skip Scandalous till next week. We just want you to know that we're not ignoring it. But let's start with a little Christmas segment. We're going to talk about Elf, which opened up November 9th at the Al Hirschfeld. Peter got a chance to see it, so Peter, why don't you tell us about it?
I like Elf greatly. I'm very surprised that last year when the reviews came out, they weren't as enthusiastic as I wanted them to be, because I do believe it's a lovely little story. You may know it from the movie with Will Ferrell, dealing with this little foundling who just happened to sneak into Santa's bag and got taken to the North Pole, and Santa had no idea who he belonged to, so he had to keep him for a while, and now here he is, 30 years old, all grown, much bigger than the other elves, and finally he overhears two co-workers while they're doing toys that he really does belong to human beings, and so he's going to go back and find the human beings. I really believe Elf has one of the most significant lines in the history of the musical theater, and I mean that. And wow, that happens when he goes into the office of his father, and he's so excited. He's an excitable guy, which of course turns off his father greatly. But he goes into the office, and he's so excited, he just grabs a guy by the legs and picks him up high, just out of excitement. And the guy says, I already have a boyfriend.
Oh, right.
Now, that is significant, because there was a time when a show that would appeal to children, that parents would bring their children to, would never dare to have a line like this indicating homosexuality. And now homosexuality has been normalized to the point where parents are there with their kids and nobody's putting hands over any kids' ears or anything like that, because kids today know. And it's a wonderful thing. Now, aside from that, it's a terrific show anyway. It has heart. It has soul. It has very nice melodies, though I will admit it suffers from a type of Newsies syndrome. in Newsies, you have anthem after anthem after anthem, dealing with, you know, we're going to take over the establishment. Nobody's going to kick us around anymore. Those types of feelings. In Elf, you have Christmas song after Christmas song after Christmas song. There are many that deal with that subject because, after all, we're dealing with Santa Claus and we're dealing with the time of the year. And, of course, there's a good deal about the fact that people don't have the Christmas spirit. However you feel about Christmas, there is a fascinating line where somebody says, "I've ruined Christmas," and the elf says, "No, you haven't ruined Christmas. Nobody can." And that's a nice line, nobody can. And you really get convinced as the show goes on that nobody can ruin Christmas, and certainly not Chad Begelin or Matthew Sklar, who wrote the score, or Bob Martin, who adapted the film. So it's pretty nice. Now, this year's cast is slightly different, and we do have Beth Level, I'm happy to say, as the elf's, shall we say, stepmother. Mark Jacoby, I don't think, was in it last year, and he's very good as the father. And what's so interesting, too, is he has a vague resemblance to James Caan, who played it in the movie. He's quite good at somebody who has to play somebody very, very stern at the beginning, and he has to warm up. You know it's coming, but he really makes a very nice journey about the way he warms up. What's also
he was in it last year.
Was he?
Yeah.
I can't say I remember a minute.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me that. Jordan Gelber this year is playing Buddy, and he does a very nice job of showing the exuberance of of Buddy, the elf. And the thing about him, you must remember, is that he was an original cast member of Avenue Q. He was the one who couldn't get a job. Here he plays somebody who has a job, but he's in the North Pole, but he doesn't do well at it. So that has a problem. It gives him a problem with self-esteem. But I'm telling you, when he gets to the Empire State Building where his daddy works, he's very excitable and a great deal of fun. We do have a new kid this year because Matthew Gumley, the kid who played it last year and did so wonderfully by it, is growing up. You know, he got too tall, I guess. So Mitchell Sink plays the little boy who finds out he has a brother in Buddy the Elf, so he's very good too. And it's also wonderful to see Leslie Kritzer playing Jovi, a co-worker who is somebody who is very down on life and Christmas. She even admits to being a bitch. She brings up that word, and she is gradually changed as a result of her interaction with Buddy, who is totally guileless. That's what's so wonderful about the character. At one point, he misses a date and with her, and he says, "But I have a good excuse." And she says, "What is it?" He said, "I forgot." And you know, and he really believes this is a good excuse. He's so confident that this counts as an excuse. And a good one. Yeah, so this is a fish out of water story. Let me also mention Adam Heller is a very severe corporate guy who is Mark Jacoby's boss. He's very good in a stern role, so I liked him a lot. A lot of Broadway favorites who you may have seen along the way, you may not really recognize them by name, such as David Hibbert or Nancy Johnston, but they're in it too. The thing is, there is somebody in the cast who you may not recognize at all, even though he's reasonably famous, and that's Wayne Knight, because he plays Santa Claus, and because he has, of course, all the Santa Claus regalia, especially the beard, he really isn't recognizable as Wayne Knight, but he's there playing Santa Claus and does a nice job as the narrator. I think it's a charming show. I think the score is very worthwhile. Leslie Kritzer has a very good song about being in love with an elf and the problems that involves. And while she's delivering it, I'm thinking, you know, there aren't that many rhymes with elf, you know what I mean? Shelf and self, and what else is there? They come up with a stretch that's really endearing for that song. So God bless us everyone, you know, including Chad and Matthew for writing a perky song of despair. I know that sounds oxymoronic, but nevertheless, that's what it is, a perky song of despair that Leslie Kritzer has. So I recommend Elf. highly, and I hope this year the reviews are better for it. It deserves it.
All righty. So that is Elf. Michael, you haven't seen it this incarnation yet, but you did see it previous years, and if I remember correctly, you loved it?
Yeah, I loved it, the first one. And that's interesting, Peter. I guess it's so interesting. I guess Mark Jacoby made more of an impression on you this time.
I guess so.
I always like him, and that's not an easy role.
That
father role. He's really impressed me in roles that are difficult, including Frederick in Night Music. He was one of the best Fredericks I've ever seen. I really think he's terrific at playing those types of roles. And I'm delighted that Beth Lovell is back because, of course, she's the greatest. And I am very interested to see Jordan Gelber. I thought Sebastian Arcellus was terrific the first time.
Me too.
And Leslie Kritzer. I mean, just everyone loves Leslie Kritzer.
Oh, I'm glad.
So it sounds, I can't wait. And I'm so happy that... it sounds to me like we have two absolutely fantastic Christmas shows on Broadway, at least two, because I loved A Christmas Story, which I guess we'll talk about now. And it has not always been the case. I was by no means a fan of The Grinch. I really did not like that show at all, and especially the score. But here we have two shows with two great new scores by two separate sets of people, and I think that's fantastic. It is interesting, though. I was just talking with a friend of mine who's a producer, a theater consultant person, and he said that, and when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. It's very difficult to make money off of these shows.
Sure.
Because what's the most... they can run them in any one place about 2 months at most. And then the other thing is, of course, they can't use the same sets in different places at the same time. You know, normally mm-hmm. if you have a show like that, it can tour and you amortize your costs that way. But if it has to be done during the same time period, then obviously you can do it in different cities, but you're going to have to build
all
several,
right.
You know.
But, you know, it's very interesting to me. In the 1963-64 season, one of Broadway's best, there was the musical version of Miracle on 34th Street called Here's Love by Meredith Wilson. Not a good show. However, it opened in October. It got bad reviews. It didn't have big stars in it. Janice Page, Craig Stevens, you know, not big stars. And yet it ran until July. It ran 300 somewhat performances. And at that time, people felt, you know, hey, if it's a good show, you know, you hear the expression Christmas in July. You know, I mean, if it's a good show, what difference does it make? Why must a Christmas show be simply shown in the month of November and December?
That's exactly what I said to my friend when we were discussing it. But I said it does seem to be the mindset now for some reason. I wonder if that's an excellent example, Peter. I wonder if there are other examples. I don't imagine there have been that many shows.
No, I'm sure there haven't. But
yeah, and you know, I mean, Annie has a Christmas scene.
Yeah, but
and,
the power of the show is not Christmas.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, when you advertise a show as A Christmas Story,
right.
You're really saying this is a Christmas-centric theme. And Elf has a Christmas-centric theme, too. As I say, every other song deals with Christmas. So I know that that's a bit of a liability. And it was funny, by the way, when Beth Lovell meets Santa Claus in Elf, she actually says to him, I loved you in Miracle on 34th Street. I noticed she didn't say, I loved you in Here's Love. I know, no, she didn't do that. So, anyway, I'm sorry, go on.
No, but it is interesting because on the other hand, you could say, well, yes, I mean, maybe they feel like if they only do these shows at Christmas, they're more special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and will sell more tickets during that period. Whereas if they did, you know, I mean, they could theoretically try to just keep A Christmas Story running or Elf, you know, because they're both terrific shows. But then, you know, how long would they run? And then would that, you know, if one of them ran for whatever, 2 years, would that then decrease the demand for bringing them back
sure.
during the holidays?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
All righty. So Elf leads us off with the first of our holiday type of shows, but we also have a Christmas story that Peter has been able to follow through many of its development stages. So Peter, let's talk about that. And Michael also, did you see that? You saw
yes.
Christmas Story?
Yes.
All right. So actually, Michael, why don't you start with that and we'll get Peter's color.
I really adored it. I think it's quite a significant improvement on the film itself, I have to say. I never really was such a fan of the film, except for the incredible performance of Peter Billingsley in the role, in the central role of Ralphie, the kid who's at the center of the story. He's just amazing. But to me, the humor of the film largely escapes me. There are things, lots of things that happen in the film that are supposed to be funny, but to me come across as more or less disturbing. And yet, though all of those things are retained in the musical, but they're just tweaked in a way that I found them very funny. Two examples, there's a point where Ralphie's little kid brother is being dressed by his mother to go out, you know, in the winter cold, and she overdresses him to the point where he's got like probably like 12 layers on, and he can't even put his arms down because the clothes are so bulky on his body. And in the film, you know, he just seems incredibly uncomfortable. I mean, it's almost like she's torturing the child, and he seems honestly, you know, uncomfortable and very, very unhappy. But in the show, they do basically the same thing, but it's done in such a way that he doesn't really seem terribly upset by it, and that makes all the difference in the world. And it's very, very funny. And then there's also another bit where one of the minor characters is triple dog dared to stick his tongue onto a flagpole. Because to see, you know, whether or not it will prove this urban legend that his tongue will get stuck to the flagpole and he won't be able to remove it. So in fact, he does stick his tongue on the flagpole and he does get stuck, and he starts in the film, you know, he starts screaming basically and is crying and is very, very upset. And finally the adults have to come and get him off somehow. And again, almost exactly the same in the show, but just not done in such a dark way. It just funnier. The kid, you know, it seems shorter. The kid doesn't seem as upset. So that's, you know, the kind of skill that's been displayed in this adaptation. I wrote down a note. I would say this is a textbook example of how to musicalize a non-musical property. They seem to have picked exactly the right moments to musicalize, and they've done them just in the perfect way that's required. There's a famous repeated line in the film. The engine of the plot is that little Ralphie wants a BB gun, a Red Ryder BB gun, more than anything in the world. That's the one thing he wants for Christmas. And everyone, his parents, his teacher, everyone else keep telling him, even Santa Claus tells him, "You'll shoot your eye out, kid." So this has been used as the title of one of the biggest showstoppers in the show, and it's done as a tap number featuring the teacher, played brilliantly by Caroline O'Connor, and the kids in the class, including this incredible child who looks like he's like 8 or 9 and does this extended tap solo and just brings the house down. So that's a highlight of the show, and shows how they used a tremendous amount of imagination. Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, the music, the composer and lyricist, in adapting the show. Oh, and here's an interesting point, Peter. Maybe you can speak to this. A friend of mine who saw one or two of the previous productions said that at least one of them, the teacher in that number, "You'll Shoot Your Eye Out," was costumed as a witch. But now she's not. She's just, it's kind of like a more of a vaudeville number, and she's in a kind of a sexy Christmassy costume. So I
can't say because I only saw the first act. I went to a tech rehearsal in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So as a result, it took 3 hours to get to the first act, and I was far from the home I love. So as a result, I had to get back on the road. So I can't address that issue. I will say, Michael, that John Rando told me that that young boy who dances so well.
Yeah.
Is somebody who they didn't expect to cast at all because vocally he isn't as strong as the other kids. But the point is he was so good at dancing, they just had to take him. Another smart thing about the show that I liked and that I see has been retained because I went to a press preview and I saw three of the numbers is the fact that much of the time the rifle is kept in the box.
Yes.
And that is so smart because keeping it in the box it comes in makes it less of a weapon. Of course, one of the great things about the show is that the kid wants the gun because he wants to protect people from danger. Now, of course, where he lives in Indiana, there isn't that much danger, but nevertheless, he has these fantasies, which leads to one of the best numbers in the show,
yes.
Ralphie to the Rescue, in which he thinks he's going to protect his teacher because people are going to come in, they're going to kidnap the teacher, but he will prevent it from happening. So that it's better than, you know, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to start getting back at the bullies who have driven me crazy. That's not what it is. You know, he has a noble reason for wanting the rifle, and that's a very significant thing.
Yeah, that is another one of the greatest numbers. I adored the show. And I have to say, I was not. Well, there was an annoying thing that happened beforehand that kind of predisposed me to maybe not be in such a great mood to enjoy it.
Did someone vomit on you?
No. Oh, my God. What a horrible story. I guess we'll have to explain that. Yeah.
Well, that's later on, and we're going to talk about that. But Grace, you're talking about, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Still to come. Wait for that one, folks.
Oh, yes. Please stop, get your coffee, and come back and listen.
I arrived with my friend. We were approaching the theater from 9th Avenue, walking along 46th Street. And as soon as we got past 8th Avenue, there was this huge line, literally almost to the corner of 8th Avenue and 46th Street. And my friend said, "Is this the line for the show?" And I said, "Oh, no, it's impossible. It can't be." It was at this point 14 minutes to showtime. And sure enough, that line was for the show.
Wow.
And I don't know. I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe there was a bomb scare. If it's something like that, obviously, you know, okay, we'll give them a pass. But I don't think so. We got up to the front and we were talking to other people and someone said, and I said, "Why is there such a line at this point?" You know, and a friend said, "Because they only have one door open for people to go into the theater." I think maybe they do it to create quote unquote mm-hmm. excitement, mm-hmm. you know, but in the meantime, that's just not right. I mean, you know, we all know that people actually tend to line up sooner nowadays for Broadway shows than they used to. So I'm sure that a great many of those people were there at half hour when the house normally opens. And I really don't know what the reason is, but I just think that they should address that because it really, I don't think it's right to keep people waiting in it. And you know, some people were coming in after the show started and that probably contributed to it. As the show started, I heard a lot of rustling of like candy wrappers and things like that. It seemed like it was going to be an inattentive audience, not really into the show, just there because this is the thing to do at Christmas and bring your kids. But I have to tell you, within 5 minutes, people were like absolutely into that show. You could feel it. And it is over-amplified like most shows today, but not severely so. But I could tell that people were paying attention. Like I was looking around and the rustling stopped as far as I could hear. And it's really a testament to the show. I loved it. I loved the score. What else do I have to say? The only thing I didn't like was the set. I thought it looked very cheap. It actually reminded me of The Grinch, one of my least favorite shows. There's a sort of a false proscenium that remains for the entire show that looks like, I supposed to look like snowbanks, I guess, but it just looked really really, really cheap to me, and I didn't think it was anywhere near the level of the rest of the show.
Well, there had been some noise about the fact that they had trouble raising the money. So maybe what will happen is the next time we see Christmas Story, if it goes well this time, and I'm suspecting it will, that maybe they'll spruce them up for the next go around.
Oh, you're right. I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me. Maybe. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost looked like, I wonder if maybe the set pieces were from The Grinch. But they're doing that at Paramount? Am I wrong?
Wow, boy. You know, yeah. I remember hearing that was going to happen. I haven't heard a word about that.
Yeah, me either. That's why I'm asking.
You know, if that's still happening, the media machine is not in full bloom, to mix a metaphor. But wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's right. I haven't heard a thing about that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Boy. Well, they do tend to do publicity in different ways when shows are done there, but for God's sake, we should know about it.
You
know?
Yeah.
anyway, what else? There are dogs in the show, which I had expected. Two of them, two huge, fabulous dogs, brilliantly trained by the fabulous, legendary Bill Berlone. Erin Dilley is lovely. We really don't see that often. Lovely as the mother, both acting and singing. I forgot how lovely her voice is. John Bolton is hilarious as the father. Again, to me, Darren McGavin in the movie is not that funny. It's just he's more off-putting than anything. It's hard to put my finger on it, but Bolton is hilarious. And this kid, Johnny Rabe, who plays Ralphie, is just fantastic. Interesting, his last name, Rabe. I mean, I guess if he were related to David Rabe and Lily Rabe and Jill Clayburgh, I guess we would know that. And it's not in his bio, so presumably he's not. But maybe that's something to research. But yeah, terrific show, amazing choreography by Warren Carlyle. John Rando, I think has been hit and miss in the past, but I'll tell you. Somebody made this show delightfully funny, and the pacing is perfect. And assuming it's him, he really deserves an incredible amount of credit. I just thought it was so well done, and I cannot recommend it more highly.
I didn't see it with dogs. Do the dogs fight?
No, there's a running gag that I think, again, I don't know the movie that well. I think it's in the movie that the father keeps being chased by the neighbor's dogs.
Okay, because if the dogs fought, that would resonate with me, because the dogs are called Pete and Lily, and my ex-wife's name was Lily, so I would like to think the two dogs fight like crazy, you know, but anyway.
Like dogs.
like dogs, because Pete and Lily sure fought like junkyard dogs, but that's another story.
So I did a quick check, and Grinch is playing down at Madison Square Garden December 13th through the 30th.
Wow.
So we're a couple weeks away from them really hitting us over the head with their marketing, maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. I see a lot of Christmas decorations around town, and we're certainly a greater distance from December 25th than we are to December 13th. So I think they should be on the ball.
I know, December 13th to the 30th, that's 17 days.
Well, you know, I guess that explains it partly. I mean, that theater is huge. So that's why the run is so short. And maybe they thought, you know, and who knows, maybe the hurricane affected.
Yeah.
Maybe they thought, let's wait a little bit till people settle down. And
that's fair.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we haven't mentioned yet, Peter, right? We have Tracy Bennett. It was Tracy Bennett supposed to be in Christmas Story? Wouldn't that have made it better for you, Michael?
You know, it's funny you say that because...
no comment.
When I met Carolyn O'Connor at the press preview, I said to her, you know, I heard you were in Australia or something. I can't remember what it was. I hear you were awfully good. And she named like three or four shows. And I said, no, that's not. And then I remembered she did End of the Rainbow in Australia. And
really?
Pe- Yes, and there have been people who have told me that, as hard as it is to believe, that she was even better than Tracy Bennett. I can't believe it, since Tracy Bennett, as we all know, was so magnificent in End of the Rainbow. So, but really, people who saw both tell me that Caroline O'Connor did one better. So who knows, Michael, you might have even liked Caroline O'Connor in, since you liked her so much in this show, you might have even liked her in End of the Rainbow.
I loved her in this show, but I...
But you wouldn't like her in End of the Rainbow, because it's really certainly the play, too, that's a problem for you
as
well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, 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 so...
But there again, you know, I mean, this is you know, that's show business, kids. The Caroline O'Connor role in A Christmas Story was played in one of the previous productions by Karen Mason.
Oh, yeah.
From what I am told... did not do this one because she chose to be in Rebecca instead. So,
You know, I'll tell you, there's been a lot of cast turnover in this Christmas Story as time has gone on in its previous engagements. But the one constant has been John Bolton. Oh. And it's really nice that they believe in him so much to do this. He's a terrific performer. I saw him go on for David Hyde Pierce in Curtains playing... the detective, and I'll tell you, I thought he was better. So I'm I'm delighted for John Bolton, who I think is a terrific performer, and this is a very nice role for him as the father who is desperate to win a contest and does, and is convinced that the prize that he is given, which is not a great prize, it's really a significant prize and a testament to his brilliance. And the way he convinces himself is very skillful. So so I wish him well.
Did you get to see him, Peter, in The Last Smoker in America?
Yeah, he tried really hard to make something of that.
He did. He did. I mean, he's one of those people who can, if he's got good material, he really can just knock it out of the park.
Sure.
And even when the material is not that good or problematic, right, he can still be funny because he's just so innately talented and funny.
I worked with John about 15 or so years ago, and John did he do the production or did readings for me when I was producing Neil Berg's Prince and the Pauper? And he couldn't be a nicer person and really, really talented. And I always think, oh, we're going to have a big breakout season for John Bolton this year. Something's going to come up. Maybe
here it is.
Perhaps yeah, absolutely. But you know, Christmas Story having a limited run and opening and closing right in this time frame, you know, you kind of forget about it when Tony Awards roll around. So it'd be interesting to see if they I wonder if they're going to invite the nomination committee at least to get nominations.
Oh, I'm sure.
I hope so. You know, the thing is that, you know, I feel bad that Elf at best will be nominated for Best Revival. Because I really feel that it should have been a Best Musical nominee, but now it's too late for that.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, James, because, I mean, we have Matilda coming, and by all reports, that's supposed to be just really fantastic. Yeah. But, you know, one could certainly conceive of a season where Elf or A Christmas Story were by far the best musicals. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there have been many past seasons where I would have picked either of them before things that actually did win Best Musical. So wouldn't that be funny if there were no Matilda this season? And let's see, what else is coming that's supposed to be really good? Well, Hands on a Hard Body. Well, anyway, you see my point. That would be something if a Christmas show won the Tony because it really was the best show.
All right. So we're going to go from A Christmas Story on Broadway to A Christmas Story, the CD. Michael, you got a chance to listen to the new release of it, which is very nice that it's come out. So it'll be a nice little CD that you can buy and give to somebody while taking them to the last handful of performances for Christmas. So tell us about the CD.
Well, it's delightful. As you just mentioned, there have been, and Peter mentioned, there have been cast changes over the period of the development. On the recording, we have Tom Wopat in the role of the narrator, basically Gene Shepard, as opposed to Dan Lauria, who's on doing it on Broadway now, and both of them are both great. And we have Liz Callaway, who one of all of our favorites as the mother. And let's see, as you probably won't be surprised to hear that that Ralphie is also different, because I'm sure that person has already grown up out of the role. And wait a minute, where is it? I'm looking on the cast list. I don't see it say Ralphie.
The kid is even changed from last year. I mean, even in 1 year, presumably, he got too big. Johnny Ray.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's at the bottom here. I'm sorry.
Oh, he gets an and credit?
Way at the bottom. After the chorus, actually, and introducing Clark Hallam, H-A-L-L-U-M, as Ralphie. And he, you know, on the basis of the just the recording alone, he was also terrific. And, you know, I wanted to make another point here, and not to slam Annie again, although I'm kind of not, you know, I mean, I'm willing to do so because I thought it's such a disappointment. All of the kids in A Christmas Story, and there are about, I don't know, at least 12, 15 of them. Every one of them is just sparkles on stage. And I made a point of watching even those who have no solo moment, but they're always in character. They're always delightful. Whenever they have a line or two to say, the line is completely intelligible. And it's interesting to me how that could happen. And then you go to see Annie, and there's really, whether it's the talent level itself or the direction or a combination of both, there's just no comparison between the two. So somebody, a casting director, a director, somebody deserves an unbelievable amount of credit for these kids in A Christmas Story, who are just beyond charming and incredibly talented.
All right. Also, other CDs that have been released that we might want to talk about: A Carols for a Cure, which is the annual Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS beneficiary of all the different Broadway casts that get together and record a song related to the holidays, and they put it on this CD every year, which is usually great. I haven't heard this year's CD yet, but Michael, tell us about that.
Well, it's, you know, I always look forward to it every year. It's just fun to hear the cast do a wide variety of Christmas songs, traditional and non-traditional, and often songs written, I think, especially for this project, and really interesting arrangements by Broadway arrangers and others involved. This one has items such as the Evita cast does Los Tres Reyes Magos, which even I know enough Spanish to know that that means it refers to the three kings. And you have Spider-Man doing a song called Call Your Mom, and the cast of Chaplin doing You Don't Have to Be Alone on Christmas. You know, I could go on and on. Let's see, what are some of the most interesting? Newsical does something called A Perez Hilton Christmas with Perez Hilton as the guest star.
Isn't it interesting that Perez has kind of whole transitioned into a Broadway thing, and he's doing a lot of Broadway coverage and off-Broadway coverage in his in PerezHilton.com, which was traditionally more Hollywood and celebrity-oriented, and all of a sudden he's become very New York and Broadway and off-Broadway-centric.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. That I've noticed that too. I mean, there's lots of this is a very full CD. There's Jersey Boy, cast of Jersey Boys. One interesting thing is there's a number from Kinky, Cyndi Lauper representing Kinky Boots, which hasn't opened yet, and doing Blue Christmas, which is a lovely song. Pick that up. And of course, the proceeds all go to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS.
If you go to BroadwayRadio.com, I'll have a link in there for the link directly to Carols for a Cure, so you can, you know, lots of our listeners are out of town, and they probably won't be getting into town to have the post-show curtain speech where they try to hawk some CDs and raise some money for Broadway Cares. But you can purchase it online and have it delivered to your house and give it to all your Broadway fans. Buy one extra for yourself. And it goes to a great cause. And it's, you know, they're real collector's items. You're not going to see this anywhere else. And as Peter has brought up many times in the past, you know, that third chorus boy on the left, you know, can end up being Al Pacino in the future. So
right.
You might be able to get those early, early works of artists.
Well, in fact, when Brian Stokes Mitchell ever appears at the Theatre World Awards, he always brings up the fact that he was so impressed that John Willis noticed him in Mail, a quick Broadway flop in which he didn't have much to do. And here's Brian Stokes Mitchell doing so well. And he has a new CD out, which I can recommend highly. It's called Simply Broadway. But more to the point, he does something I don't recall any other artist doing. What he's doing famous show songs, but he's really playing the character as well as singing the song. It's not just a pop rendition. So when he does If I Were a Rich Man, and he does, he's Tevye. When he does How to Handle a Woman, and he does, he's Arthur. By the way, he does the very seldom heard verse to the song, the introduction to the song before he gets into How to Handle a Woman, which is not on the original cast album. We don't have that from Richard Burton. It has been recorded elsewhere, I'll grant you. So so that's what's really nice. He's playing the characters. He's not just singing the song. So he's also playing George in Sunday in the Park when he does Finishing the Hat. And I think it's very representative that the opening song is Feeling Good from Roar of the Grease Paint, because he is feeling good in this CD, and I recommend it very highly.
All right. So, Michael, we also have a re-release of Cabaret.
Yes, this is the 1968 London cast of Cabaret, which is very notable for the fact that Judi Dench plays Sally Bowles. Also, Lila Kudrova playing Frau, what's that character's name?
Fraulein Schneider.
Thank you very much. And Barry Denon, whom many of us know as the original Pontius Pilate in Jesus Christ Superstar, in the concept album and in the film as the MC. So that's, you know, from a historical standpoint alone, I think it's really interesting. I have to say, I don't like it.
Ah!
No. Well, I like. Really? Yeah, I like Barry Denon.
I didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't either.
Yeah, yeah, no, I was surprised. I think Barry Denon is terrific. To me, this is going to be a controversial theory, but both Lila Kudrova and even more so Judi Dench, they sing so poorly that the acting doesn't compensate for it. And it's interesting. You know, Jill Haworth, if that's the correct pronunciation, we've been through this several times, was famously slammed by the New York Times for her portrayal of Sally.
And other people, too.
And other, okay, thank you. Thank you.
Yours truly as well, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, we've discussed this, haven't we? Because, well, it's fair to say, I guess, that some people felt that her singing was not up to snuff, even though it's very interesting, because some people feel the point is that Sally Bowles is not supposed to be terribly talented. So then you have the question, well, how untalented should she be? How bad of a singer should she be to make the point without making it painful to listen to? And I think, I don't know. I mean, I think that that Jill Haworth sounds like Julie Andrews compared to Judi Dench.
I would say exactly the opposite, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
I would definitely say that. By the way, I met Julie Andrews the other night, but that's another story. At a musical called The Great American Mousicle at Goodspeed, which I could recommend very highly. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But nevertheless, I think that Judi Dench makes Jill Hoth sound like Julie Andrews. I think she's substantially better, and she has much more character to her voice. So, now that we know Judi Dench's voice from all those speaking roles, to say the least, be it from Shakespeare to Shakespeare in Love to James Bond. The fact is, it's kind of interesting to hear her sing under those circumstances. So I'm delighted with Judi Dench. I will not disagree with you about Lilac Drover. What I'm putting in my Masterworks Broadway column is fans of vibrato and trills will have a field day here. I mean, you know, really, because she really has quite the vibrato, and it's very surprising. One of the things that's interesting to me about this, and I wrote about this last week for my Masterworks Broadway column, and it got a good number of comments, both on the site and private emails to me. The controversial lyric that was dropped in Boston is back. That's in the MC's number with the gorilla. If you could see her through my eyes. She wouldn't look Jewish at all. I remember in Boston that line was in, and I remember people complaining about it, and I remember one woman saying to me, they've got to take that out. And I thought, they're not going to take that out. And they took it out. It really is very interesting that by the time they opened in London, they were confident enough to put it back in. I asked Joe Masteroff, the book writer, about this, and he told me, you know, our original title was Welcome to Berlin, and we were told by theater party ladies, nobody will go see a show with Berlin in the title. No Jew will go to that because it's 21 years ago, it's still too fresh in the minds, and as a result, you've got to change the title. So that's why there was a lot of gun-shy stuff on that, and what's interesting is that in London, they felt confident, but also I think it had something to do, this is my theory, that it had something to do with the fact that in London, where they really suffered more at the hands of the war and Hitler, I think they didn't mind being reminded of that as much. So that line is back. There are other little differences too in lyrics here and there, in So What and in the Pineapple Song. So it's always fun to see why lyrics have changed. I think it's a quite good recording because Lilac Drover doesn't have that much to do, granted.
Yeah.
She does have a charm. She is kind of adorable. You may know her from either the movie Zorba the Greek or Zorba the Musical when it was revived. And that's what's interesting to me, too, by the way. Here's Harold Prince in February of 1968 casting Lilac Drover in Cabaret. In November of that year, Zorba opened on Broadway. Now, why didn't he take Lilac Drover to reprise her role when she did it 15 years later? She got a Tony. Why didn't he take her? And I will admit that having heard the recording made quite clear to me why he didn't take her.
Interesting. Well, just to clarify, I'm not debating the character, quote unquote,
I know you're not.
In Judy Dench's voice as opposed to Jill Howard's. I'm just saying that to me, whenever Judy Dench tries to sustain a tone, it's so awful, and not even she can't even sustain a pitch, and it just takes me out of it completely. To me the acting doesn't compensate for it, and please don't misunderstand me. Judy Dench has no greater fan than I.
Oh, sure.
Other things, I just to me specifically, the singing is not good enough, and especially in terms of, I mean, you know, quality of voice is one thing, but singing off pitch is something else, and I think she does. So you may disagree. Speaking of taking someone out of a show, I find that she wouldn't look Jewish at all thing fascinating, because I think maybe it wasn't that they were afraid of it, quote unquote, so much as that maybe they felt it was so shocking that that people really couldn't recover from it and really kind of experience the rest of the show. I mean, because there is quite a bit that happens after that number.
It the line was changed to she isn't a Miskite at all, and it doesn't even make sense on a basic level.
Oh no, absolutely.
The MC
absolutely
would never sing that. He wouldn't use a Jewish word because the whole point of the lyric is Germany has become so anti-Semitic that it's now spread to the cabaret, and he has utter confidence that he can deliver this line comparing a Jew to a gorilla, and that everybody in the audience will have a wonderful time and enjoy it. So it really says something about the times and how they're changing, while She Isn't a Meese Guide at All doesn't say anything of the kind.
Yeah, but didn't you point out, or was it someone in response to what you wrote pointed out, that you could say that that's fascinating because that could bolster the theory that the MC is Jewish. And he says that because he does know what it means. Now, whether he would realistically do that, knowing what's happening to the Jews, or, you know, one could also say that he, even if he's not Jewish, that he knows that that's a word that they use and is using it, and is using it, you know, against them in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I do see that. And of course, in the revival, we did find out in a brilliant move that he was Jewish, because of course at the end he's in the uniform of the concentration camp with the star on it. So yes, revisionist history makes him Jewish, and I'll grant you that. The other question becomes, does the MC write his own material, or does he have writers who write these songs that he's going to sing? You know, so that brings up another thing too.
But people in cabarets always, they have a lot of latitude, I think, to kind of improvise and just.
Of course. But nevertheless, we're getting it pretty deep here, and I guess we should just abandon and go on.
Talking about latitude and a lot of people riffing, Forbidden Broadway's new CD has come out. Michael, what's the name of this CD?
Well, it's Forbidden Broadway Alive and Kicking.
Alive and Kicking.
Okay. Yes, and it's on DR. It's from DRG, and it's a great CD in one of the latest in a series of great CDs. The cast of this current production is super, as I'm sure you've heard and we've discussed. Natalie Charlet Ellis, Scott Richard Foster, Jenny Lee Stern and Marcus Stevens, with David Caldwell at the piano. Aside from the performances, what did I particularly enjoy? The Once parody is quite hilarious. I mean, several of them are, of course, but that I think is maybe one of my absolute favorites. And when Marcus Stevens does Matthew Broderick in Nice Work If You Can Get It, which is here called Nice Song If You Can Sing It, he really nails Matthew Broderick. It's absolutely brilliant. And this CD also has a really terrific booklet with more and larger photos than one usually sees in these booklets. So that's a stocking stuffer for you to keep in mind.
All righty. And finally, we're going to talk about a CD called 17. And Peter, you were going to talk about that?
17 was a musical in 1951. It did run beyond 17 performances, but it wasn't terribly successful. Kenneth Nelson, later more famous as the Boy in the Fantastic, and Michael in Boys in the Band, was the leading man, a young man who is indeed 17, who falls desperately in love with a girl who comes to town named Lola. Because she's the new kid on the block, every boy is smitten with her. And the other girls in town are furious. In one of the best lyrics, she's taken our boys and she ought to be poisoned. It's not a great score. It's not a great score. However, it does have one of the great charm numbers of all time when late in the show, the character's name is Willie, is talking to his handyman's father, the family's handyman's father. And he's amazed because he thinks of the handyman as so old. My God, here's the father. How old can he be? And as it turns out, he said, well, I got married young. I got married when I was 17. And Willie starts thinking, wow, I mean, I'm that same age. I could get married today. And it's a lovely charm song, and it's worth the price of the album alone.
Alrighty, and that's also a Masterworks Broadway. as well. Michael, in keeping with this theme of a possible stocking stuffers, can we fit Performance of the Century into a stocking, which is a new book?
It's going to have to be a big stocking because the book is 9x12. I actually measured it.
Oh.
So I guess I would describe it as definitely a coffee table book, maybe a little smaller than that, but no, it's pretty big. And this is hot off the presses from Applause Books. The complete title is Performance of the Century, 100 Years of Actors Equity Association and the Rise of Professional American Theater. And the text is by Robert Simonson, who is one of our best writers, one of our best theater journalists. And I've only had a chance to skim through this because I literally got it just a couple of days ago. But I had to mention it because it looks spectacular in terms of the layout and the photos. I mean, where are you going to find a 9x12 color photo of everything from let's see, here we have Jennifer Lim and Gary Wilmes in Chinglish there's on another page we have I guess when I saw it, a color photo from 1948 of Tallulah Bankhead and Donald Cook in Private Lives. I mean, it's spectacular. There's a vast treasure trove of theater photos, you know, of course, dating back decades and decades, and they don't often find an audience because, you know, for obvious reasons, there aren't that many places for them and fewer places now than there used to be, fewer books like this. So this book seems to be absolutely invaluable as not only a history of equity and of actors, but just as a pictorial history. There's an incredible photo on page 16, a half page black and white photo of the famous strike in August of 1919, which basically gave birth to equity. In Columbus Circle, you see this incredible photo of these people marching in Columbus Circle and picketing. So yeah, this is this is a great book. I'm telling you, you've got to pay attention to this one.
Great. Well, we will have links to Amazon and various different places where you can get it there. It's another great opportunity for a gift that you wouldn't think that other people are going to get for their Broadway fans. So we're going to wrap up here and talk about a few different things. Michael got a chance to see the Encores Gala. Can you tell us about that special evening?
Yes, it was a terrific evening. Only about 90 minutes in length, but it was, I guess, quality rather than quantity. Joel Grey, it was a combination of people repeating some roles that they had done at Encores and also new people doing things that they hadn't necessarily done at Encores. So on the one hand, we had Joel Grey reprising Mr. Cellophane and still being really pretty amazing doing that. And Kelly O'Hara doing A Perfect Relationship, which she, from Bells Are Ringing, which she did at Encores. Let's see. And Rob McClure, who is now a Broadway star, doing Once in Love with Amy from Where's Charlie, complete with audience sing-along. So it was really nice to have him back doing that because that, I'm sure, is the first time that many New York audiences became aware of him. What else? Blasts from the Past included Debbie Gravitt, Rebecca Luker, and Sarah Uriarte Berry reprising Sing for Your Supper from Boys from Syracuse, which was quite some years ago at Encores. And there were some really Raul Esparza did Her Face from Carnival just absolutely beautifully. He did not play the role at Encores. It was the aforementioned Brian Stokes Mitchell. So I'm not sure if he was unavailable or what, but Raul did it a beautiful heartfelt, heartbreaking version of it. I think it sounds to me like the key was brought up a bit to suit his voice, but it was really a very unforgettable moment. And then he also, you know, at the end of the other end of the spectrum, did Tchaikovsky from Lady in the Dark. So it was, yeah, it was quite a night for him.
Now, Michael, I didn't go, but I'm told also was the overture from Nowhere to Go But Up.
Just about to mention it.
Were you?
never even heard of this show. 1962 Winter Garden Theater.
That's right, 8 performances. Dorothy Loudon was in it. That's where she won her Theater World Award.
Oh, I guess maybe I heard it in that context when I heard discussing that. But I know nothing about it. But boy, that that overture was fantastic.
Was it? Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting a bootleg recording of it from somebody. If anybody out there taped this, let me know. You know, because really, I don't have anything from Nowhere to Go But Up at all. By the way, the lyrics were written by James Lipton, now better known for
the
Actors Studio. So, a quick flop, Tom Bosley was in it. Martin Balsam, who you don't think was a musical comedy person, but he was in it too. They played Izzy and Moe, the two people who used to go around during Prohibition and straightening people out. So how was it? How was the overture? It sounded good?
Yeah, no, it was a crowd pleaser. I mean, people were like, oh my God. It just goes to show you that, you know, what was considered second or even third rate back in the day now sounds pretty damn good many times, you know.
All right. You also got over to the Met to see an opera version of The Tempest.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to briefly mention it because it really, I guess I was made angry by the critical reaction to this opera because the critical reaction to this opera, I'm talking about the music now, and the libretto, was uniformly very, very positive, I believe. And this opera is written very much in a modern style, with extremely dissonant, lots of dissonance, lots of jagged harmonies, nothing that remotely really resembles a traditional melody going on for more than a measure or two, violent shifts of key, setting text in a way that is entirely unnatural, so that if you have a line like when will you be here this evening, they would set it in a way so that the stresses make a point of not falling where they would if you said the line. And I can't help remembering that when Stephen Schwartz wrote a beautiful score, a beautiful melodic traditional score for his lovely opera called Seance on a Wet Afternoon, it was roundly, uniformly panned. And I just really can't believe at this point that people are still doing that. They seem to regard anything like that, any composition in a traditional melodic form, as old hat and uninspired and just not worthy of their attention and their praise. And I cannot object more strongly. I think that Seance on a Wet Afternoon is 500 million times better as an opera than this one. This also has one of the worst librettos I've ever heard. It reduces Shakespeare to the most simplistic, idiotic, rhyming couplets you've ever heard in your life, with Peter, you'll be unhappy to know, constant false rhymes. The one that I wrote down is, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Nephew and left you.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. This in a libretto based on a play by Shakespeare. So I mean, the sets were very great. The singing was fantastic. very, very bad job by the composer and librettist, as far as I'm concerned.
All righty. So just going to leave off with one more thing that was in the news in the last couple of days, is that there is a new play coming to Broadway based upon the Yankees. And Peter and Michael would like to say a few things about that. So, Peter, why don't you start us off?
Well, it's sort of surprising because this is supposed to be the third jewel in the Triple Crown. The NFL was represented by Lombardi, about Vince Lombardi, the Green Bay Packers coach. Magic Bird came representing the NBA, dealing with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And here comes a play about the Yankees that will represent Major League Baseball. However, neither one of those shows was a hit, and Magic Bird was such a quick flop that I'm surprised that we're now getting into this. Now, granted, the New York Yankees brand is far more far-reaching and has far more appeal to many people, and we are, after all, in New York City. And neither of those other two shows had a New York affinity. Still, you know, it's early in the game. All we know is there's going to be some sort of show about the Yankees, and let's hope it's as good as Damn Yankees. That's all we can really hope for.
So, Michael, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I was surprised for the same reason that Peter said, and as we discussed earlier, I really liked Lombardi a lot. I forget, Peter, did you?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. No, I thought it was very well written and very well done. I liked Magic Bird a lot less, and apparently so did the critics and the audiences, because it was a very quick flop. But such a quick flop that I thought maybe they would stop. But these producers, as you say, I guess they're counting on the brand, but it's still the Yankees brand. But it is odd. I mean, if I don't have the release in front of me, but if I recall correctly, they really just announced that they are planning to do one, and I think they may have. Did they use the word commission? My point is, I don't think that they've even said who the writer is going to be. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it does seem incredibly premature. I don't know why they even felt they needed to announce it now. Little. I mean, it's not as if if they have the rights to do it, it's not like somebody else is going to swoop in and do a play about the Yankees. But these producers, I have to say, I mean, apparently they deserve all credit for being very 100% behind what they do, but they are not, you know, of Broadway, and they seem to continue to make a lot of mistakes, such as announcing this so prematurely. And also, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking before the podcast began, the press release that they themselves put out for this does not bode well, because it talks about America's national pastime, and they spell it P-A-S-T, separate word, T-I-M-E. So I don't know. I mean, that's kind of, if you don't even know how to spell pastime, you know, and you're doing a show about the Yankees.
The national pastime.
The national pastime, yeah.
Right.
That gives me pause.
Let me guess here. I don't have any of this information, but it had a very nice story in the New York Times, and it got picked up in lots of other things. And the Yankees are, as we mentioned, a well-known brand. They're probably the most profitable sports franchise in the world, above Manchester United, which is probably the second largest. It's a football league.
It is.
So you take all those things into account, and I think that they probably put this press release out prematurely in our eyes, because it really helps to raise money.
Oh yeah, I mean, I suppose, but it will be interesting to see what they come up with. I one thing I would advise, if I don't know if this is an incredibly obvious thing to say, but whoever does wind up writing this play, I would strongly advise them to pick a very comparatively short period in Yankees history to focus on. You know, maybe. Well, I mean, there's so many possibilities, but because I think if they are so foolish to make an attempt to tell the entire history of the Yankees, that would probably be a tremendous mistake.
I think they should just focus on all the times the Yankees beat the Red Sox. So
they could do that. You may be joking, but that would be terrific.
Yeah, I think that would be one note after a while because it happened so many times.
A lot of drama. You know, you have you can almost have like a sort of Rocky thing happen there where you have your 1977 Yankees win the World Series, then you have your 2001 Yankees who lose after the tragedy of 9/11, and then you have your late 2000s Yankees that are going to win the World Series and come back. So you can do that in three acts. But you know what else is happening in three acts?
What? I'm listening.
Have you heard this?
What?
So there's a new movie being written by Aaron Sorkin about Steve Jobs. And Aaron Sorkin said this week that the movie is going to be in three acts with three 30-minute segments about three major moments in Steve Jobs' life. And the first is going to be the founding of the Macintosh, the release of the Macintosh. And the second one is going to be the first Pixar release. And the third one is going to be the event that kicked off the iPod, as the three different moments that have changed the world, and they were driven by Steve Jobs. Everybody's talking about this hour and a half picture being written for the movies, but I'm like, this would be a great stage show, wouldn't it?
That does sound like, yeah.
So if the movie's in three acts, are we having two intermissions?
Well, I'm sure there'll just be some sort of fade in music and go back into it. You know, they don't typically like to break any movies up because it's all about the popcorn and the soda.
But, you know, that's funny that you said that, James, because right before you said that, I was thinking that might be a way to do this Yankees play.
Yeah, exactly.
You could do it in three acts, and maybe act one could be about the Babe Ruth era. And act two could maybe be about, I don't know, the Mickey Mantle. Was he the Yankees? Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was.
And, you know, actually could be about...
Don't forget Joe DiMaggio. You know, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
Lou Gehrig. He played, until Cal Ripken came along, he played in more games consecutively than anybody else. It was, in fact, in the monument out in Yankee Stadium center field, it actually says he played 2,000 whatever it is games in a row, and a record that will probably never be broken. It actually says that on the monument. But
I wonder if it says that in the new Yankee Stadium. I haven't been to the
Good point.
They haven't been out there yet.
They may have done some cosmetic work on that plaque. Nevertheless, there was a time when it did have that on there saying a record that will probably never be broken. And there was every reason to believe it wouldn't be, for that matter.
Please forgive me for sounding like a broken record, but
yes.
I'm sure that we've talked about this before, if not on the podcast, definitely in person, about Field of Dreams, the movie being converted into a musical. And I wish somebody would be able to get that project off the ground because it's one of my favorite movies. And I think that it would translate really well on stage.
Did you cry at the end?
Oh, who didn't?
I sure did.
Oh my God, I'm choking up right now when he goes out to have a catch with his dad.
Yeah. Oh, fabulous.
It's heartbreaking.
It is a beautiful movie. It could make an amazing musical.
So, you know,
Field of Dreams exclamation point.
Is it that doesn't even have to be a musical exclamation point. Could even be a play. But let's talk about the exclamation points.
Yeah, we'll end up with that.
First of all, I have to apologize. My mistake. I don't know why I had this in my head, but I was sure that Scandalous had an exclamation point, and I was wrong. So
yeah, it doesn't. I live near the theater.
From what I'm hearing about the rumors about Scandalous, it might have an exclamation point at the end.
Well, it
really started in essence with Oklahoma. I'm sure there are other ones that really did it, but because Oklahoma added the exclamation point when it changed its title out of town, it got more attention for that. So I did a little hunting as a result of A.R. Gurney's statement in his play, Buffalo Gal. He mentions there's going to be a musical version of the Cherry Orchard. It's going to be called Cherry Exclamation Point, you know, and I wish we could put this joke to rest, you know. So anyway, I went hunting, and I found out that at that point, since Oklahoma, this is a few years ago now, 760 musicals were produced. 36 had exclamation point, which is 4 7/10%. Certainly not a figure that warrants the joke that musicals routinely take exclamation point. Now, I got this from IBDB. Now, you know, again, this is at the mercy of typists, people who are doing inputting information. Like, for example, my cast album of Let It Ride, the lousy 1961 musical version of Three Men on a Horse, has an exclamation point after the title, and IBDB didn't catch it. So
let's not forget Carnival. We've discussed that before.
Yeah, Carnival. Boy, there are so many different theories on whether or not Carnival has an exclamation point. You know, so anyway, you know, it's 4.8% if you include Let It Ride. You know, I mean, and that is not enough to really deal with the fact that this is the way musicals go routinely. That they have exclamation points. So,
and here's an interesting question that I met. If you want to do more research, Peter, okay. Has there ever been any non-musical play with an exclamation point?
Yes, I think there have been. Not one comes to mind at the moment, but gee, that is a good question. I'm a little ashamed of myself. I can't think of one.
Because I think that would be. I mean, that would partly explain why people always still use that joke when they're joking about something inappropriate being made into a musical. Mm-hmm. If plays did also.
Oh, I could think of one. Yes. Help Stamp Out Marriage, a commercial comedy from the 60s. It was a big hit in London. It didn't have that title there. I think it was called Say Who You Are. But what Help Stamp Out Marriage definitely had an exclamation point. Didn't help it to run more than a handful of performances. I remember reading it. Women found out their husbands were unfaithful to them, and they cut up all their clothes into little pieces. That's all I remember from it. But nevertheless, that comes to mind. So,
does Oh Dad, Poor Dad have one?
I don't think
no,
so.
No, I don't. For some reason, I had that in
I
my.
So.
My
head, I understand why you would feel that way, you know, but I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you seen the movie of that, by the way?
No, isn't it Rosalind Russell or something?
Yeah, there's a big story behind that movie, but that's for another time.
Okay. Do we think it's possible that Star Wars, the musical, will have an exclamation point?
Yeah, I can certainly attest to the fact that Strauss and Adams were interested in writing a Star Wars musical because I have two of the songs from the show. One's a ballad, I don't remember, but another one is Hands Your Man. It's a pretty good song. You know, whether or not there should be a Star Wars musical, I always maintain if there were a Star Wars musical, the obvious promotion that they would have is that you get a discount if you sit in either R2 or D2, you know. So I'd like to see that.
Or C3.
Oh, that's fantastic. Seat 3, P.O.
C3.
Right.
Yeah.
So I bring this up because in the news this week, Disney has purchased George Lucas's works, the Star Wars works, and there'll be a seventh Star Wars movie that's in the works now, just starting to be written right now. And there was a Star Wars musical that happened somewhere out in the Midwest in the late 90s or something, and it was in a 30-seat theater or something like that, and the Lucas estate, the Lucas Corporation went all nuclear on them and shut them down. So it'd be interesting now that Disney owns it and Disney's got such a strong foothold in the Broadway community that maybe a Star Wars musical will happen, but
I'll
have to see.
I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to see it if it doesn't have the Bill Murray version in it. Remember what I'm talking about? Remember years ago on Star Wars, fighting the Star Wars.
And if it does happen, maybe we will read about it in Variety, which Variety changed hands again this week. I mean, I can't even count the number of times that Variety's had a new owner in the last 10, 15 years.
Well, I didn't know
that. And they are going to start decreasing the print subscription of Variety. They're not going to do a daily anymore, as far as I'm reading. But on the good side is that the Variety website is going to go free, because right now it's hard to read Variety if you don't have one of their $199 a year subscriptions, and they're going to remove the paywall on Variety. So maybe we'll be able to read about Disney and Star Wars, possibly the musical and the Yankees play and Steve Jobs movie and all the other great things that happened. So that's about it. So anything
that's
you guys
want to...
You guys want to talk about that's coming up this week before we go? No? Okay.
Well, I'm seeing the new Christopher Durang play, which I'm really looking forward to because I always enjoy his stuff, even, you know, when it's even when it's not perfect. I think his comic sensibility is hilarious. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Great. Do you guys ever go do a Handel's Messiah anywhere through it? I'm looking for a good one.
The closest I get to is when I listen to It's a Simple Little System for Bells Are Ringing. That's the closest I get to the Handel's Messiah.
Well, you know, I have to say I actually was smart enough to attend one of the last, I don't know if you guys know this, but the famous legendary choral director Robert Shaw used to do the Messiah every year at Carnegie Hall, and it was a sing-in. Everyone who came brought their scores, and the entire audience sang along, and that was, I'll never forget that. That was kind of amazing.
Yeah, I've done that. So, all right. So, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you want to listen to us in another way, you can get us through the Stitcher app, which is an app for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry. That way you can listen to us on the fly and stream it to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. We need to get back on track with listener volunteers. A number of you have emailed me and contacted me, and I'm sorry we got tied up with the hurricane, but we're going to get back on track for helping out with doing a few projects with us, maybe some transcriptions, some web work, things like that, helping us just get Broadway Radio a little bit more organized. If you want to contact us, you can go to BroadwayRadio.com, and contact information for Peter, Michael, and myself and me will be there. You can leave us a voicemail and do all sorts of other fun things at BroadwayRadio.com. I want to also also remind you guys. I want to remind everybody that we did have a show this week on Thursday, a few days ago, that you might have missed. It was kind of a catch-up show to catch up on the last 2 weeks that we'd missed while we were out getting electricity back and all the other things after the hurricane. So be sure to catch that as well if you have not already. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
My old friend.
Ah! Don't hate me.
9 years.